Welcome to our study, August the 19th, 2017, series 37-9. It is entitled, Servants of the Householder. I want you to consider the following quote. Jesus said unto him, he's speaking to Judas. Judas said, oh, I want to be a part. I want to be included amongst your disciples. And Jesus, not willing to turn any away, gave him the following admonition. Again, I quote, Jesus said unto him, the foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. But the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Matthew chapter 8, verse 20. Christ says that even though the birds and the foxes, the animals of the forest, you know, at the end of the day, they need safety, they need rest, they have a place to find it. But not so with me. It symbolizes what we're going to reveal as we bring this scripture to its greater depth. How can we find the Lord? He has no permanent address. This study is about identifying the Lord. It is designed to show how a man, indeed all of humanity, I put emphasis on that statement, can find Christ. Likewise, we'll explore the concept of the Lord's desire to have a place to lay his head. Therefore, let us turn to Matthew chapter 22. Even in my car, occasionally if my neck is tired, I have a headrest. Not so with Christ. He's got no place to lay his head. Let me speak to the profundity of this very surprising statement by giving you reference to verse 42. He says, what think ye of Christ? Whose son is he? Verse 42. And they say unto him, the son of David. He saith unto them, how then doth David in spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand, till I make thine enemies thy footstool. If David then call him Lord, how is he his son? This is a good transition text for us here in Matthew chapter 22. Because the question was posed, and we could delve more deeply into this particular theme as we've done in past studies, but for now I'm just interested in two points. What think you of Christ? Whose son is he? And the Pharisees, the scholars of the day, nobody understood theology better than the Pharisees, acceded to the fact that Christ had a father. Therefore, my question is, since the Holy Father, the power, the highest, the quote-unquote almighty, is the one whom we have identified through careful study to be the Father of Christ, not ancient David, as the Pharisees misunderstood, then why does it seem as if Christ is so hard up for a home, a place to lay his head? Why is it that he seems to be almost envious of the birds of the air and the foxes of the field? They have a place of rest. Yet you're the son of the highest? You speak of the many mansions. Where is your rest? Doesn't that detract from the claim that you're making, Lord, that you are the Son of the Highest, that the Father sent you? Oh, to understand the answer to that question, we have to really understand the meaning of the headrest. Likewise, we'll find it useful as we advance. The Lord said, David, by the power of the Holy Spirit, called Christ Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand, till I make thine enemies thy footstool. Now, if you continue to read that text in Psalms 110, you will see that the Lord did not fully quote it, but you can always go back and read up on it yourself to make the second leg of the point that I'm going to make. And that is the promise that the Lord is going to send forth the son of David with the rod and give them empowerment to rule his enemies. In fact, let's take a quick peek there. This is the text that the Lord referenced in Matthew 22. And I quote Psalms 110, verse 1. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send a rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thy enemies. Now, the reason why that point brings us significance to this study is it shows a message that has heretofore been underemphasized and emphasized at all. And that is the fact that David, a man after the Lord's own heart, was surrounded by enemies. And he was told to sit in abeyance, to sit in a forbearance, to sit in patience till Christ, the one whom he called Lord, makes his enemies his footstool, until the rod of his strength, shepherd's rod message in the hands of the son of David, goes forth of Zion, and with it he's able to rule his enemies. The reason why I find that point significant, you'll see more so as we advance, is that the day of this rest has not come yet. Because David, being a man after the Lord's own heart, was still surrounded by enemies. And the Lord was intended for him to have victory over his enemies. Therefore, we need to look forward to the advent of that day. But in synopsis, the Lord's message to Judas was that empowerment has not been endowed to the church yet. We're still beset by our enemies. If you join me, Judas, you have to follow a path of humility, a path of denigration. And I don't know, Judas, if you're in for that commission. So let me forewarn you. The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head. Speaking more about the enemies, let me take you to Psalms chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. Why do the heathen rage, and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. I told you that David's enemies are Christ's enemies. The reason why the fox retreats to his hole, the reason why the bird retreats to her nest, is to find safety from their enemies. Therefore, these people that are at war against the Lord and against his anointed say, verse 2, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. And say he is laughing, looking for a day when he's going to laugh. Evidently, that's the day that we're alluding to in Matthew chapter 22, as it points us to Psalms chapter 110. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. That's the day of the Lord's victory. That's the day when he's able to finally rest his head. But let us not stop our analysis there. Let me allude to the undertone in the message that comes with recognizing that the Lord and David have enemies together. Why did the son of David inherit the Lord's enemies? Because he represents the Lord's emissary, his vicegerent, his power of attorney on earth. And therefore, the enemies have targeted him, because if they could defeat him, they could defeat the Lord. And consequently, our concept of Christianity has been a misnomer. We have not been a people of peace. But over the last 2,000 years, since we left Palestine and took the gospel to the Gentiles, we've been beset by wolves in sheep's coats. by enemies that are seeking to attack us. And that's a semblance of what we receive from the message of Matthew chapter 10, verse 34. The Lord says, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I am come not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and a daughter against her mother," etc., etc. The Lord, when he came down here, he came down to install disruption. And Judas was figurative of those that had the incapacity in their lives to bear under the great distress of this disruption. There are people that want to find joy and rest. People that want to find celebration. Oh, the Son of David has arrived now. They may have thought to themselves as they sought to unite with Christ. So therefore, we're going to have victory over the Romans, whom they perceived to be their enemies. They didn't realize that the Romans were going to be their enemies over the next 2,000 years as well. The enemies of those who join Christ. I know what it says in Isaiah 9, speaking of Jesus, "Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. He shall be called," it says. "His name shall be called the Mighty God. He shall be called the Everlasting Father. His name shall be called the Prince of Peace." That's what he was called, and this is what the Lord prayed that Jesus would be called. It doesn't mean that that's who he was. And that's why in the closing prayer of Christ, John chapter 17, no time today to return to it quickly, even, but the Lord says that he wants the Father in his closing prayer to glorify Jesus with his own self. But Jesus did not install the peace. The peace continues onward and forward until finally the shepherd's rod message blazes forward and gains rulership in the earth. What is your part? John chapter 8, verse 32. It says, and I quote, "Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, If ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The only thing that's going to free you from the onslaught of the enemy is the truth. Let that be a window into really the essence of the battle. But when they continue in the Lord's word, in other words, when his word is raised up again in the last day, and they continue to walk in it and embrace it, then that's the day when they're going to have their freedom. Until then, we find out in Hebrews, there's a rest that remaineth. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 4 through 11. "For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his work. And in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest, seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein. And they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief." Again, he limited a certain day, saying in David, "Today, after so long a time, as it is said, today if ye will hear his voice, harden not your hearts." For if Jesus had given them rest, then would he not afterwards have spoken of another day? So Jesus did not bring to you your rest. He promised a future day. He wasn't the Prince of Peace. Though Paul hammers home the point in verse 9 of Hebrews 4. "There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief." Now Paul didn't know the distinction between Christ and God, so the God of the Old Testament he considered to be God, not the vicegerent, the power of attorney for God. And so he credits the Lord with having entered into his rest. But that rest was only the proverbial day of rest that pointed forward to another day. A day which Jesus told us was going to come. A day in which still remains for the disciples, for the faithful. And that day represents the Lord's head rest. Let me just hammer home the point so that it doesn't become even more confusing. And let's put it in a sort of a neat, succinct way. The great controversy is that which began the Lord's disturbance. It was Christ's problem. Wasn't Jesus' problem or the Father's? Christ taught through Jesus, and war waged hot. For Jesus was despised and rejected by the church. As shown, the leaders chose to kill him to preserve their place in the world. Per Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 20, the Hebrews were not a people of faith. And this faith comes by belief in his word. That's why he told his disciples, indeed, you must continue in my word. Therefore, let us advance the concept by showing you Numbers chapter 12. A dispute between Miriam, Moses' sister, Aaron, Moses' brother, and the Lord. Chapter 12 of Numbers, verse 6 through 8. And he said, hear now my words. If there were a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision, and will speak unto him in a dream. My servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all mine house. Who is faithful in all mine house. Verse 7 makes the point. Even though the Lord did not have a permanent fixture, he considered himself to have a house. He said, Moses is faithful in all mine house. Now, they had just left Egypt. They were in the wilderness. You need to understand that the house of the Lord represents a collection of people who are united with him. And the most faithful is acclaimed to be Moses. But why is it, therefore, then, if it's curious enough, I mean, if the birds of the air have nests and the fox have holes, why is it that Christ has a house but no headrest? Christ had no rest in his house because there were hell raisers in his house. That's why he had no rest. But his rest represents a collection of people in his house who believe. And thus, by doctrine, finally disempower Satan. How did Satan get involved in the mix? Revelation chapter 12, verse 7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. So the dragon instigated a disturbance. And as I told you, the disturbance was whose problem? It was Christ's problem. The dragon fought Michael. And Michael's a synonym for Christ. And this is what caused the disturbance. This is why Christ did not have a place to lay his head, did not have a headrest. He was constantly fighting. Now it tells you that the dragon was cast out of heaven. It says he didn't prevail, but it never says that he was defeated. And Christ is waiting for the day when he can defeat the father of lies. And that's going to happen by the disciples continuing on in the truth. Therefore, let us be clear in this one point. The warfare is not with tanks and machine guns, and not with military armament. The warfare is over lies. It's a doctrinal warfare. And consequently, until we get our doctrine right, none will have place in Christ to lay their head. None will be at peace. Let me show you a little bit of what I'm talking about from Isaiah. I remember speaking of the days of the Seventh-day Adventist Church I remember the days of marching up to church with my children and my wife and finding a parking space. And it was never a period of rest. You know what I'm saying? I always knew that I had a target on my back. Mm. I always knew that people were telling others to stay away from me. I always knew, no matter how friendly and how well presented I presented myself. I mean, I could have come in with the blue jeans and grease spots on a work shirt. I never did. Or a three-piece suit, nice and tidy. It still evoked a target of hell. My enemies were still raging against me. But yet still, that place, just like heaven was Christ's abode, that place, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, was the denomination from which the Lord would launch His victory. That's why He says in Psalms 110, "The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand, until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send a rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thy enemies." Consequently, Zion doesn't represent the collection of the Seventh-day Adventist Church eternally. She only represents the collection of the faithful that emerge from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And therefore, I don't look back with nostalgia on yesterday. Isaiah chapter 51 has a little bit of counsel for us. It says, verse 7, "Hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness." So there are people that are studying, but they still need to be reminded that they have to listen to the Lord. "The people in whose heart is my law, fear ye not the reproach of men, neither be ye afraid of their revilings." Why shouldn't they be afraid anymore? Why should not they be concerned? Because the day is going to come when they're going to all be taken away, if we continue to read on. We're just going to skip now, though, to verse 16. Isaiah 51, verse 16. "And I have put my words in thy mouth, and I have covered thee in the shadow of mine hand, that I may plant the heavens." Now, come on now. Lord, what do we care about the heavens? You're confusing us. I thought your commission was to establish peace on earth. That was the promise that was accompanying Jesus' birth 2,000 years ago. This is what we want. We want peace on earth. No, but that peace on earth is not going to come until I plant the heavens. Unbeknownst to us until recently, we know that the Lord has taken representatives from every generation to heaven, and He has prepped them, as we're going to see later on in the study, to advance the cause of His kingdom. This is the reason why the world doesn't know about you. I'm just itching to get out there and participate in the debate, but I have to sit on His right hand. He says, "I have covered thee in the shadow of mine hand." That's the mustard seed, you see. "That I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth, and say unto Zion, thou art my people." In other words, the Adventist message, the three angels' message, is going to explode onto the scene with great success. They're going to be recognized as Christ's people, His house, and His church. They're going to be bastions of successful evangelization. Let's just skip over to the continuation of the theme in verse 7 of Isaiah chapter 52. "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth." I tell you a point that's been underemphasized. The victory is in the doctrine. It's in the publication of the truth. This is why I'm glad that we have enthusiasm about reading the publications. Because it shows us good tidings. It shows us peace. No matter how much warfare I get from Jonathan and Walt and from some of the others, I'm able to beat them back. Because I'm prepping for the day when my enemies are defeated. I'm showing you the lies that exist by Satan and his warring angels to destroy the church.
No, I don't worry about the Illuminati, about the Masons, about any other. And Christ didn't worry about them in heaven. He just continued forward, looking forward to the day of his eternal rest.
Delving a little bit deeper into the subject, you know why this is getting a little bit fundamental. Fundamental, then it gives us a launch point to dive deeper, you see. Matthew chapter 13, verse 24 through 27. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. Oh no, our ears should perk up. We should come to attention, because it's telling us what the kingdom of heaven is like. That's something, a vision that we can all get. A man was sowed good seed in his field. What did he do? He sowed the seed in his field. He sowed the seed in his field. That wasn't the end of it, though, was it? But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. People talking about the Jesuits are infiltrating the church and the Masons and some of the other antagonists that are constantly trying to inundate our doctrine, trying to destroy E.G. White, trying to declare war on the righteousness in the church. It's no more than the Lord warned you. He says you're going to be faced with wolves and sheep's coats. And that's the enemy. Well, whose enemy? It's my enemy. Christ said, that's my enemy. Since it's his enemy, then why am I bothered with it? Because you've been included amongst my disciples. You're included amongst the collection of saints that, unlike the birds of the air and the fox of the forest, you have no headrest. I think it's something important here, this expression. So much so that I decided to entitle the study after it. It says, so, the servants of the householder, the servants of the householder, the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath the tares? And he said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then that we go gather them up? But he said, nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, he root up also the wheat with them. We've had our purposes sort of wrongly directed under the shepherd's rod movement. But that was before the rod of our strength went forth out of Zion. It's going to be strengthened as we correct our doctrine. But our focus had been the removal of the tares. Slaughter of Ezekiel 9. You see, the Lord says, don't worry about the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. Let that be my problem. Let the wheat and the tares grow together. And then I'll let the angels take care of the tares. A point worth notation. You have the servants, they're making an appeal to whom? They're making an appeal to the householder. Why do they make an appeal to the householder? Because he's the one that sowed the seed. Now we can parse the distinctions and we can get clarity about the authority that we work under. Because he tells you plainly in verse 37, he that sowed the seed is the Son of Man. Now you know why he's got so many enemies. Now you know why, quote unquote, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat, end of quote. He wasn't necessarily focused on you. He wanted to destroy the work of the Son of Man. So hell left heaven and continues to haunt us here on earth. It haunts us more especially because we've united ourselves with the Lord. Matthew chapter 13 shows you when the rest comes. Continuing on his illustrations about the kingdom of heaven, the Lord tells us the kingdom of heaven is like to a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds, but when it is grown, it is the greatest among herbs, and becometh a tree, so that the birds of the air come and lodge
and the branches thereof. Now we see the dual dimension of the sowing for the first time, don't we? We had Christ sowing the field. He had the field. He sowed the wheat in the field. And then he returns back and does another sowing of a singular seed. And that gives you an understanding about the kingdom of heaven. If you don't understand about the mustard seed or about the sower, then you have complete and total darkness in understanding about the kingdom. I find it amazing because the church was cast in Jesus' hands all these 2,000 years. But there's a time when the Lord begins to take the reins in his own hands again. There's a time when the mantle's transferred from Jesus back to Christ. And that's when he plants, at the end of the day, the mustard seed. And he does so, why? So that we could have rest for our heads. So that we could finally be at peace. We know that the rest comes because it becomes a tree. It becomes greater than all the other trees, and the birds of the air find lodging in those branches. That's why they're in the air. They're looking for a place to lodge. They can't lodge and find their rest, can they? Until the mustard seed grows. Yesterday, we considered the birds of the air, those people that were formerly fallen, and they're going to be resurrected. More especially today, we consider the birds of the year, the Enochians, those saints that Christ took up with him. They're longing to come back to planet Earth so that they could find peace. They left planet Earth without having peace. And now they're longing for the day when it can be reestablished. But let us not let the point escape our attention. Rest is vested in another personality. Rest is vested in the Son of David, as we saw from the Psalms. He's the one that's told to sit at the Lord's right hand. He's the one that's told that's going to go forth with the rod of strength out of Zion. We all this time thought that our rest came from Jesus, and our rest came from Christ. No, our rest comes from the one whom the Lord plants in his field, the singular seed, the mustard seed. And this is the reason why the Lord hid both his name and his address. You remember reading about that, don't you? Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 20. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be. For they are a very forward generation, children in whom is no faith. The Lord told you that he was going to hide his address, his identity, until the time of the end. I will hide my face from them. He hides his face by speaking to them clandestinely through Jesus, as he promised in Deuteronomy chapter 18. In fact, Isaiah shows you that his address and his identity are still hidden. It tells you in chapter 8, verse 11 through 17, for the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling, and for a rock of offense, to both the house of Israel and a gen, and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall, and be broken, and be snared, and be taken. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. Now we can understand with greater clarity that your redress and your relief comes in doctrine, in the testimony of Jesus. And I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Therefore, the day is still yet not upon us. And I say still, I'm talking about, we've gone through 6,000 years, in fact, 3,500 years of the church since its institution at Sinai, and the Lord has hidden his face from them. But now is the day when we can anticipate the unfurrowing of his identity, of his address. We can look forward to the day when he revisits us and can communicate to us face to face through his servant like unto Moses, the one that is faithful in all his house. We learn from John chapter 4, verse 31. In the meanwhile, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. I have meat to eat that ye know not of. My meat, verse 34, is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. Again, let us reemphasize the finishment of the work. The end was a point of theology that the disciples were ignorant of it. Ignorant by Jesus' very own testimony. He says, I have meat to eat that you know not of. Continuing forward, he tells us to look up. And we'll see in verse 35 that the fields are white already to harvest. The Enochians are in place. They're ready for harvest. Then he adds a little bit more meaning to our study today. A little bit more understanding into the work that he is desirous to do. That work which was hidden from the disciples. That work which Christianity was not knowledgeable of all these many years. He introduces a new person, the reaper. And he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. Herein is that saying true. One soweth and another reapeth. Therefore, the Lord's work, the finishment of the gospel, is vested in the mustard seed, the one that does the reaping of his harvest field. We know that to be the case because he distinguishes between the sower and the reaper. And we found out that the sower is representative of Christ. Makes you sort of wonder, though, there was this great battle in heaven. There was this warfare that took place. And showing you the master chess player that the Father is. You ever play chess? You play chess with a master player, it may take you a long time for you to figure out why he makes a certain move. Sometimes you don't figure out till you hear the words checkmate. Well, the Father was a master player. You see, he, in the midst of the great controversy, told Christ, I'm going to give you rest. I'm going to give you peace. You know I'm going to do it? I know that you're being lied upon. I know that the devil is telling the universe that you're not worthy, that Lucifer is a better candidate to be empowered because it's a struggle for power. Well, I'm going to do something very special. Let us get together, make man in our image and in our likeness, and let them have dominion. And so he created Adam and Eve, and he gave them the commission. He says, be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over everything that moveth upon the face of the earth. Which means that Adam and Eve are separate and distinct from the children. Their children now totals 7.5 billion people. These are people that Adam was supposed to have dominion over. And the Lord is not going to have his peace until the Son of Man, because Adam faltered, the Son of Man steps forward and is able to take the rod of correction in his hand and leave Zion to punish the Lord's enemies. That's Father's resolution to the great controversy, which means that the people even in heaven that remain out of loyalty to Christ don't understand. Which means that nobody on earth understands. The only people that are able to purvey the truth are you, the disciples. You're the only ones that can bring freedom to humanity so that they can have lodging in the branches of the mustard seed in the Lord's field, and so that the angelic host who witnessed the great controversy are going to say what? Christ is right. That's why the Lord promised in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 4 through 7. And it came to pass that night that the word of the Lord, who? Christ, the word of the Lord came unto Nathan, saying, go tell my servant David, thus saith the Lord, shalt thou build me an house, for me to dwell in. Whereas I have not dwelt in any house since the time that I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day, but have walked in a tent and in a tabernacle. In all the places wherein I have walked with all the children of Israel, spake I a word with any of the tribes of Israel whom I commanded to feed my people Israel, saying, why build ye not me an house of cedar? Then he goes on to say, verse 10, moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them. Aha. This is the day of their planting. He lays the foundation of the earth. He plants the heavens. And he says he's going to plant Israel, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time. So he's going to prepare a place of rest. And since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an house. The house means rest from your enemies. Your enemies are inspired to warfare by the Lord's enemies, because you're his chosen. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee. Now David is going to be vested in the mustard seed, your son, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 16, and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. David was his vicegerent and his representative on earth, but David did not have peace. The Lord was going to build him a house so that he and his people could have eternal peace. And this is the rest that waits for those that are elected. And this is the peace that we are to anticipate by advancing forward the cause and the trumpeted cause of Christianity. In Matthew chapter 20 speaks to the householder. Remember Matthew chapter 13? The servants went to the householder. Verse 1, the Lord revisits that concept. For the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. We could tie that back into our study of Matthew chapter 13 by revisiting what we've proven, that the sower is the householder. Remember, the servants came and approached the householder and said, we found tares scattered amongst the wheat. And then the householder said that the enemy had done this. Now we understand in chapter 20, verse 1, that the householder is added again. It says, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that is a householder, and he hired laborers to go into his vineyard. Now we know what the purpose of the laborers was. It was to communicate gospel truth. And that truth was destined and predetermined to defeat the devil. And we could now therefore understand that Christ is what? He's the householder. Which means, in this very literal sense, that he is holding the house. He promised to build a house for David, but he says, you don't need to worry. I'm doing the construction. I'm gathering the saints, and I'm going to hold it until the day that your son emerges. That's why you're servants of the householder. And that's why he shows that the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man that sows seed in the field. And likewise, he comes back and sows the mustard seed into the field. He's building a house for the son of David, just as he promised. And that allows us to give a synopsis on this theme of servants of the householder by reviewing what we've studied before in Matthew chapter 24, verse 45.
Remember studying that text?
Let's read it again.
Who then is a faithful and wise servant?
Somebody says, I'm confused. I thought we were sons and daughters of God.
Well, you're servants until you gain freedom. Then when you gain freedom, you become brothers and sisters to the Lord and sons and daughters of God. That's why it says, who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household? His household. Hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods.
That really stitches neatly in the point that Christ is building and holding the house until the time of the end. And this is what yields the defeat of Satan. This is what gives Christ victory. This is what gives him a place to rest his head. He gets rest because he has arguments, doctrines, and teachings that validate Christ's ordination. And in so doing, he validates Father's nomination of Christ. And he does so, and I'm going to show you before I close, to the praise and glory of all of the unfallen universe. Before so doing, let's just get another proof text and regather it into our study so that we can fortify this doctrine all the more. So that we could learn that Christ has been establishing a doctrine pervading people and giving them the power to defeat the devil. It's not your duty to kill the devil. It's not your duty to imprison him, to take him out. It's not your responsibility to take him out of the temple and escort him away. It's your duty to defeat his lies. Why is it your duty to defeat his lies? Because he's high and lifted up. He's got an ego that's unworthy of his presumption. He thinks that he is better than Christ. And he's deceived many to think that that may be the case. Therefore, he's purveyed lies and deceptions to affirm his misunderstandings. Thus, when somebody created after God's likeness and has dominion is able to launch forward and to defeat his lies, then Father and Christ reign victorious and Christ has his rest. That's why we're told in Genesis chapter 3, let me just read there, and I will put enmity. What is enmity? Doctrinal dispute. I will put enmity between thee and the woman. She's prefigurative of the church. And between thy seed and her seed, it, the testimony of Jesus in the Son of Man's hands, it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. So if you want to destroy the serpent, you have to destroy his head. In this case, you have to embarrass the devil and trap him in his lies. And this is the reason why Father said, we're going to resolve this thing once and for all. Hey, you did a good job creating the heavens and the earth. You rested after 6 days. But now, after 6 days of divinity, 6,000 years, we can look forward to establishing a house that will submit your post and your authority in meekness eternally. See, the reason why we need to do so in meekness is we see from John chapter 11 what the Pharisees says. They said, they saw Jesus casting out devils, healing the sick, you see, calming the storm, feeding the hungry. And when he raised Lazarus from the dead, he said, that's his last straw. We got to kill Jesus. We got to kill him and Lazarus. But why? Because if he continues forward, the whole world's going to believe. So that put them on the enemy's camp. That put them in the posture to deny you your peace. They'd rather you suffer from demon possession. They'd rather you starve. They'd rather that you remain dead, merely so they could, as they stated, preserve their place. Therefore, this is the struggle that the Lord has been up against all this time. And now the universe can see that through demonic deception, through the back channels of Masonry, the Illuminati, which the world is beginning to see the full fruition, through all of these channels leads to nothing but misery, heartache, and destruction. Why? Because people of high exaltation, people with large egos, need their heads dashed. See, they don't have the ability to step down and say, I was wrong, and embrace the Son of God. They don't have the ability to accept the Holy One of God. They have to kill Him to preserve their place. And that is a remanifestation of the hell that Satan brought to heaven, that God had cast out. So we can look forward to the day when the Son of David emerges from Zion. Isaiah 62, verse 1. For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake will I not rest, until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof is a lamp that burneth. For Christ is not going to have a place to lay his head until Zion emerges in righteousness, bearing salvation, so that the universe and the world and all the onlookers can see that Christ is right, and the Father was wise in ordaining him as his vicegerent, and that Satan was the last person that should be exalted to that post. But let us just now bring the study to a close by turning to Revelation chapter 5. When we read chapter 4, we had seen that there are four beasts full of eyes before and behind, which shows you that they're representative of Gentiles that are collected as observers through every age. Those events took place yesterday, and those events took place today. Well, one of the eyes may have been inspecting the work, let's say, in Vietnam, or in Kenya, or in the Dominican Republic. There are people back there, maybe 400 years ago. They may have been investigating and taking careful record of the deeds and the people that existed in that land. But then those people died. But their vision is not just behind, it's before and behind. They're full of eyes. Therefore, when the next generation comes, if it continues to emerge and explode, they'll have additional helpers to keep record. So they keep record with the intent of the kingdom of heaven being established so they can be reinstalled, so they can be one of the birds of the air that find lodging in the mustard seed's branches. Well, that's what we would have learned if we'd have read chapter 4. We're not going to read chapter 4. We're going to read the Lord's testimony in chapter 5, yes. John found himself burdened. Verse 4 says, and I wept much because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon. There was a book in the Father's hand. It contained the records of the righteous that were ordained not in the world but in the church. And nobody was able to open the book. One of the elders said unto me, weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof. Why was Jesus qualified to open the book? He prevailed. He gained victory. And then, referring to this event, verse 8, and when he had taken the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. The 24 elders have to be those that are not representative of beasts, but are representative of men. They have to therefore be represent those who were taken as Enochians under the auspices of the Hebrew nation. Elijah, I think of, is one. And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sung a new song. They didn't leave planet Earth with this song on their heart. This wasn't their theology. This wasn't their understanding. They were people of conversion. They learned to do what the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Caiaphasian, the pompous Jews could not do. They learned to step down so they could step up. So they sung a new song saying, speaking to Jesus, "Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God." So, you're not God, but you were worthy because you were slain. And you have redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. And has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. And consequently, they became kings and priests unto God. Why unto God? Because God is the God of the Gentiles. These are the ones that he wants to install in the different quadrants of the planet, in every quadrant. And through Jesus' blood, it gives efficacy because his church, the names of the people in the book, are able to prevail. And I beheld and heard the voice of many angels. First, he heard what the four beasts and the 24 elders. I wasn't through listening, John says. There was much more, you know, like watching a television program. There was a second episode. Now comes the second episode. And I beheld and heard the voice of many angels. Many angels. Many angels. Many angels. The voice of many angels round about the throne and the beast and the elders. And the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, thousands of thousands. They're not claiming to be redeemed. They have another message. They're not claiming they were restored by Jesus' blood. They have another theme. Saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power, 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 power. Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing." Undeniably and unequivocally, therefore, they're saying that Jesus now became worthy. The great controversy is over for us today. Yesterday, we weren't sure whether Christ was worthy, but now he came and he descended and abode upon Jesus and prepped Jesus for his commission. And it says, worthy, worthy is the Lamb that was slain. He's worthy to receive power. We didn't think that Christ was worthy yesterday. Now, understand that Jesus receives his testimony through Christ. So by affirming Jesus' worthiness, you're substantiating the plan of salvation. And you're giving acknowledgement to Christ. Therefore, you're defeating the devil because the devil said Christ was unworthy of power. I'm the one that deserves the power. That's what the devil was saying. Likewise, therefore, we see that the servants, the saints, that emerge from the 6,000-year experience culminate in the work of the Adventist message. They culminate in the reestablishment of Zion under the Gentile banner. And as a result, they're able to produce the seed that was planted in the Lord's field, the mustard seed. And the mustard seed, just as the Lord prayed in John chapter 17, allows the Father to give glory to his Son. That's the Jesus. Why? He said, glorify him with thine own self. Why? So that the Son can glorify thee. I have in my notes Revelation chapter 19. I don't want anybody here to end this study with confusion between Christ and Jesus as depicted in the judgment scene. Where do you find Christ in the judgment scene? Revelation chapter 5, verse 1. And I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside sealed with seven seals.
And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? That strong angel could be none other than Christ. And he's showing the universe that there's nobody in heaven or earth that's worthy. Christ wasn't worthy because he did not die. He did not shed his blood. Father was not worthy. He's a man, right? He's a man in heaven. Father was not worthy because he didn't come down. See, these people, the Enochians, were brought up to heaven because Christ came down. But Jesus paid the price. Now, the Enochians, they don't know the distinction between Jesus and Christ, do they? The Enochians are confused because only the mustard seed is given authority to declare the name of the Lord. And that's why in chapter 19 of Revelation, John says, verse 10, and I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said unto me, see, thou do it not. I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. And when that statement validating the testimony of Jesus is brought forward to the disciples, John, the end time disciples, and the church, another event occurs. And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness does he judge and make war. Verse 12. His eyes were as flames of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. So there's nobody in earth or nobody in heaven that has come from earth that would qualify as a man that could distinguish his identity. No man knew. That's why it's cast in past tense. Because it's the testimony of Jesus as unfurled through the mustard seed that gives revelation to Christ's identity. This is the fundamental basis for our connection to the kingdom. Father is glorified in the Son because the Son validates his wisdom in his appointment. And you all, by continuing in his word, become disciples indeed, become the purveyors of freedom, and therefore you garner benefit and blessing. Thus is such your valor as servants of the householder. By your discipleship, you shall find freedom, rest unto your soul. And with that, I bring the study to a close.